Israeli social media, however, reacted to the continuation of the war on the Gaza Strip with no concern for the risk to the Zionist captives. Here are some of comments.
Yoni ben Menachem, after more than 700 days of the war, Gaza's destruction and starvation led by Likud and Talmud, Netanyahu continues this war. Amir Tibon, after 2 years of war, Hamas roams Gaza with the Israeli captives, moving them from place to place in broad daylight without fear. Instead of rescuing the captives from this hell, the administration of utter failure continues to sell lies and myths to the public about absolute victory over Hamas. Liran Baruch, come tell us, Netanyahu the genius, how you will push for an agreement conditioned on Hamas's surrender.
Israeli commentator reports that the occupation forces fear that Hamas might activate a West Bank front, and coinciding, as according to him, with the United Nations willing and the United Nations confidence to recognize the Palestinian state. Do you see that scenario happening?
I think that the more Israel shows aggressiveness inside Gaza and inside Palestine, the more this encourages several states, including the United Nations, to do to state that Palestine is a state. And this is because no one today could, you know, Israel may have won several tactical achievements in the region, but the cost of them was losing the whole world. And the whole world today, Israel is an apartheid state. Mm-hmm. It's a state that kills children. So it lost the whole of the world for tactical achievements. That's what several Israelis are saying today, that when you put the achievements and the costs in one balance, it's always the costs that are much more
strategic
than that.
Strategic failure.
Yes, and I think that what he was saying about the West Bank, it's only part of a narrative that it's preparing the whole world that we have to act in the West Bank. So I think they will act in the West Bank, and this is part of the narrative they are preparing for that.
And do you think they will achieve it?
They will act. Whether they will achieve the goals or not is another thing. I don't think they will achieve the goals. Mm-hmm. But they will act in that. And you know, Israelis are very clear. From
yes.
day one, they said, we want to occupy Gaza. We want to act in the West Bank. They told us all their
Annex
plan.
The West Bank.
They told us all their plan from day one. Today, we're only saying this plan while achieving it from the Israeli
army. Dr. Mohammed Suwaydan, academic and writer in international affairs, thank you very much for joining
thank
us
you.
In this episode.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
When this documentary was made, a year had passed since the start of the Zionist regime's aggression against Gaza. During this period, Israelis have killed more than 50,000 Palestinians including the missing and those trapped under rubble, 60% of whom are women and children. This massive loss has driven people to the streets in protest.
Palestine, 50,000
deaths in a year is not a small number. It suggests the Israeli army is primarily fighting the people of Gaza rather than the resistance fighters. The scale of this number makes it hard to believe claims that civilians are merely human shields or collateral damage in the conflict. This has prompted reactions not only from people worldwide, especially in Europe and the U.S., but also from the International Criminal Court in The Hague.
Israel has a genocidal intent against the Palestinians in Gaza.
Despite all these protests, Israeli politicians are not sorry at all, and every day they add dozens of Palestinians to the number of Palestinians they kill. Gaza is bombarded, schools and hospitals are destroyed, and people and children get trapped. In short, the Zionist entity is killing people in a way that it seems more like venting a grudge against a nation rather than an actual war.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Arafat, His Excellency Yitzhak Rabin, Prime Minister of Israel, the President of the United States.
Yasser Arafat, Yitzhak Rabin, and Bill Clinton together in one frame. This was perhaps the most remarkable image that could be broadcast to the world in 1993. On September 13, 1993, Yasser Arafat, one of the oldest leaders of the Palestinian struggle, laid down his arms and signed a peace agreement known as the Oslo Accords in Washington. In the Oslo Accords, Arafat recognized the State of Israel and condemned the use of violence against it. In return, Israel recognized Arafat and his group as the legitimate representatives of the Palestinian people and agreed to the formation of a Palestinian Authority as a temporary administrative body. The West was pleased with the development that the Nobel Peace Prize was simultaneously awarded to the Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, Foreign Minister Shimon Peres, and leader of the Palestinian Fatah movement, Yasser Arafat. At that time, the commemorative photo was interpreted as the end of an era of enmity between Palestinians and Israelis. However, this is not the first time the West, especially the United States, had brought Arabs to the negotiating table with Israel.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States, the President of the Arab Republic of Egypt, and the Prime Minister of Israel.
In 1978, U.S. President Carter had managed to convince Anwar Sadat, president of the most powerful Arab country opposing Israel, to make peace with the regime.
I hope that the foresight and the wisdom that have made this session a success will guide these leaders and the leaders of all nations as they continue to progress toward peace. Thank you very much.
After the Camp David Accords, the West made significant efforts through both open and secret negotiations, such as those in Madrid and Egypt's Sharm el-Sheikh, to persuade other Arab countries to cease hostilities with Israel. These efforts were sometimes successful. The reconciliation of Arab countries left Palestinians feeling abandoned in their fight against the occupation. Gradually, figures like Yasser Arafat concluded that armed struggle was futile and that it was time to negotiate. This is what happened with the Oslo Accords.
A moment when we dare to pledge what for so long seemed difficult even to imagine, that the security of the Israeli people will be reconciled with the hopes of the Palestinian people and there will be more security and more hope for all.
The primary reason for America's satisfaction with the Oslo Accords was the security of Israel and the end of Palestinian resistance. Westerners believe that since Palestinian leaders had recognized Israel, there was no reason for others to act more concerned than the people directly involved and continue fighting against Israeli occupation. So they try to present Yasser Arafat as a sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, sidelining other Palestinian groups that still saw resistance as a path to liberation. The narrative was reflected in the media coverage of Arafat's return to Palestine, portraying him as a lone savior of his people. On June 12, 1994, Yasser Arafat returns to Gaza to establish the Palestinian Authority with East Al-Quds as its capital, as per the Oslo Accords. This government was expected to gain full control over Gaza and the West Bank within 4 to 5 years.
We will establish our independent state on any part of Palestine from which the Israelis will withdraw or liberate it. It is obvious and clear.
With Arafat leading the Palestinian Authority, the next step was to form the Palestinian Legislative Council. In the absence of opposition to reconciliation with Israel, the first elections were held in 1996, resulting in a victory for Arafat's allies. Consequently, all aspects of the Palestinian Authority were now in the hands of those favoring peace with Israel. In the Oslo Accords, Arafat secured a promise that no more Palestinian land in Gaza and the West Bank would be seized, and that settlement construction for Israelis in these areas would cease. Another agreement with Yitzhak Rabin was that Palestinians in the diaspora worldwide, estimated at over 3 million people at the time, could return to areas under the Palestinian Authority's control. Arafat obtained these concessions at a high cost of recognizing the occupation of a large part of Palestine, a reality that Palestinian resistance groups protested. Based on these promises and agreements, Arafat's achievements were presented as complete victory in the world media. But that was not the entire story. Despite all the hype, not all Zionists supported the Oslo Accords. Many Zionist political factions did not even consider Palestinians as human beings, let alone agree to negotiate and establish a government with them. They viewed all of Palestine, especially Al-Quds, as their own.
We want the Palestinians to say, this is our land, this is our country, this is our city.
Over the years, Israelis have forced many Palestinians into migration and displacement through harassment, killing, and threats. It was clear they would not agree to the return of Palestinians in the diaspora to areas under the control of the Palestinian Authority under the Oslo Accords. The peak of Israeli opposition to the Oslo Accords took place on November 4, 1995, when Yitzhak Rabin, who had negotiated with Arafat, was assassinated. Yitzhak Rabin was a staunch Zionist who served twice as prime minister. Besides his political roles, he was considered a seasoned general who had achieved victories for Israel through the killing of Palestinians and other Arabs in various wars. He was one of the two commanders of the Israeli army during the Six-Day War in 1967 and demonstrated such competence that he became a major general at 32 years old and a lieutenant general at just 40, the highest rank in the Israeli army. Due to his extensive experience, Rabin learned that victory could not be achieved solely through suppression and war. Sometimes it was necessary to engage Palestinians in political maneuvers to make Israel a safer place for Zionists. He realized the need for peace with Palestinians during the First Intifada, a widespread Palestinian uprising that began in 1987 and could not be quelled by Zionists no matter what they did. Although the Oslo Accords ended the First Intifada, many Zionists viewed negotiations with Palestinians as legitimizing them. This led to Rabin's assassination to deter anyone from negotiating with the Palestinians or granting them concessions, even superficially. Thus, the Zionists themselves had eliminated one of the three key figures in the Oslo Accords. With Rabin's death, the anti-negotiation faction led by the Likud Party and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu came to power. Netanyahu has been a dominant figure among the Zionists, holding the Prime Minister's office for 16 of the past 28 years. Palestinians were now concerned about the Oslo Accords, as the new government had no intention of returning the West Bank and the Gaza Strip to their rightful owners. Instead, land confiscation and settlement construction by Zionists had doubled compared to when Arafat was still armed and advocating for Palestinian freedom. The rise of the Likud Party worsened the living conditions of Palestinians, pushing unemployment among them to 70%. According to the Oslo Accords, Yasser Arafat had agreed to divide the West Bank into three areas. Area A, covering 18% under full Palestinian Authority control. Area B, covering 21% under Palestinian administrative control, but Israeli security controlled. And Area C, covering 61% under full Israeli control. The first problem of this division was that it became difficult for Palestinians to move in these areas, let alone get involved in trade, production, and agriculture.
Palestinians have to drive or ride on the older roads. When they want to travel from one town to another, they have to submit to humiliating delays at checkpoints and roadblocks.
I think the main goal is to fragment the West Bank. I think the vast majority of them are basically to block the movement of people from one place to another.
The next important point was Arafat had accepted the division on the condition that within 4 to 5 years, the Palestinian Authority would gain full control over the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. However, as time passed, there were no signs that the Zionists would honor their commitments. The situation became more unbearable for Palestinians as news of financial and administrative corruption among Arafat's supporters and the disappearance of international aid funds surfaced.
But while many struggle to raise the $20 a year now necessary to send a child to a UN school, millions of dollars of international aid have been wasted, misused, and misappropriated.
And also, you know, when the people look at some in the government, that those people used to struggle for the sake of Palestine, and today they are misusing their position, or they work, or they do something which is against the interest of their own people. You know, this makes some the people feel disappointed, to feel that this is not what we want, this is not what we struggle for.
It led to public dissatisfaction with the negotiating team. If the situation were to proceed in the same way, the legitimacy of Arafat and his friends would be lost among the Palestinian people, and the position of his rivals would be strengthened. That was the time when Bill Clinton, in the last days of his presidency, got into play and gathered Yasser Arafat and the Prime Minister of Israel, together so the good memories of the Oslo Agreement might be repeated. At that time, Ehud Barak was a prime minister of the Israeli regime.
Let me say, I am delighted to see Chairman Arafat again. The United States is prepared to do all we can to assist them in coming to an agreement. Well, I'm certainly willing to do anything I can to achieve a peaceful settlement in the Middle East.
However, things did not go forward as the U.S. wanted. Barak refused to even honor past agreements, and Arafat, having faced 7 years of broken promises, saw his honor in front of the Palestinians at stake. This is how he insisted on the implementation of the previous agreements, and unlike in 1993, it caused the negotiations to fail. The peace process had failed, and the occupied territories were like a powder keg waiting for a spark. This time, the spark was ignited by another notorious Zionist, Ariel Sharon, a ruthless Israeli military figure known as the Butcher for the many Palestinians he had killed. Sharon's visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque was seen as a final blow to the Oslo peace process. Palestinians protested the desecration, leading to widespread demonstrations that later on came to be known as the Second Intifada or the Al-Aqsa Intifada. The protests were met with severe repression by the Israeli military and police. Yasser Arafat could no longer remain silent in the face of such violence against Palestinians and Israelis' unfulfilled promises. He formally protested and, after seeing the U.S. and the West were not listening, shifted his stance after 7 years and in a U-turn supported the resistance like most Palestinians.
You have to remember why they had moved. The visit of Sharon to our very important and religious place for the whole Muslims.
Arafat's change in tone was enough for the Israelis to attack his headquarters, placing him under house arrest.
Well, this was a very strong message conveyed to Arafat and his people, that we are able to be there and to surround the place whenever we want, according, of course, to operational needs. I believe that Arafat understands this message.
Yasser Arafat remained under house arrest for the rest of his life. Despite his pleas to end the situation, even the United States ignored his requests. During this time, he developed cancer but was denied permission to leave for treatment. Eventually, his weakened body was transferred to a military hospital in France, where shortly after, he passed away on November the 11th, 2004. Later, laboratory investigations in Switzerland revealed that Arafat's personal belongings and clothes were contaminated with radioactive substances, and this meant that Arafat had died as a result of a biological attack. Now the second person present in the picture had been eliminated.
Thank you. This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Rites in Our Worship. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab, on IB English Radio. So I've titled today Rites in Our Worship, and what this is actually mainly talking about is rites pertaining to the month of Ramadan, because obviously the our worship during the month of Ramadan is a particularly significant one. I would also add a particularly sweet one. So I'm just going to sort of be taking you into sort of a few concepts around this. So maybe I'm, inshallah, a little bit deep, so maybe just give you some extra reflection and a different way of looking at things. So basically, the idea is that obviously our rites, or our rituals, another word for that, build our relationship between us and Allah. So, and this has great significance. So, the general idea behind this is, so we need, as human beings, as Muslims, as believers, we need to be attached to what we call the absolute, which is God, which is Allah. Now, if we, and I'm just going to take some, let's say, normal examples to actually explain where I'm getting at here. So what I mean is this. So imagine we're Muslims, but, you know, maybe we're not engaging in any of the rituals. So that means we're not engaging in any, we don't do our fasting during Ramadan. We don't read juz from the Quran every day. We don't, and we don't pray either. And maybe throughout the whole year we don't pray. We don't perform any particular rites. But, you know, we are Muslims. We still adhere to all the principles of our faith other than that. So in order to gain this attachment, really good attachment to Allah, if we're not doing these sorts of acts of worship, these rites, our attachment is basically still quite weak. And this is what we're getting at here. So this is what I'm going to talk about. Welcome back. This is A to Z on RB English Radio, and obviously I'm talking about the rituals in our worship pertaining especially to the month of Ramadan. So, and obviously I've just said that obviously these rituals serve the purpose of deepening our faith, for sure, and obviously with that builds our relationship and our attachment to Allah. And I particularly like this idea of being attached to Allah. And obviously I've mentioned it, you know, if we don't perform any of the rites, any of the rituals, especially during the month of Ramadan, which is so significant, then, you know, maybe our attachment is not strong enough. So obviously when we perform rites, when we perform the rituals, it's like this attachment that's developing with each time we, for example, each day we're fasting, or each day we're reading from the Quran, especially during Ramadan, then obviously just this feeling, this connection, this attachment to Allah deepens. You can imagine this is the way it works with habits anyway. If we do something once, you know, okay, so we're starting to develop a habit. If we do something a few times, then we're really starting to have a habit ingrained. But if we're doing this consistently, it becomes like a trait. And obviously, and the more we do it, then it's really part of our nature. So if you're thinking about, okay, so that attachment in the beginning was still quite, let's say, a little bit weak. So it really is an ingrained, a very deep attachment we can develop. And obviously, this is something that we really need to be thinking about during the month of Ramadan. Just take, for example, if you were to never do any, if you never prayed, never did anything else in the rest of the year, maybe if you could even just for the month of Ramadan, really just think, okay, I'm going to use this month to really start working on this attachment. Because just faith alone is really not enough. And obviously Ramadan itself, it will bring that sort of sweetness, where if you really focus on this, that each time we perform one of these rites, such as fasting, reading from the Quran, our prayers, obviously, then obviously we get a special elevated feeling with it too, inshallah. So this is just a different way of looking at it for you today. Inshallah, you tune in to another episode of A to Z here on RB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab, and farewell for today. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
There are scholars who delve into the complexities of geopolitics and international relations, examining the forces that shape global dynamics. Their work often bridges theoretical frameworks and practical implications, bringing insights into the interplay of security, economics, and diplomacy. Among them are those who focus on Eurasian integration and the evolving role of conservatism in global politics. My guest today exemplifies this dedication, contributing to academic discourse and shaping perspectives on international affairs. I am Bahman Nouray, your host. Welcome to SOAP.
Glenn Deaton is a Norwegian political scientist and author born in 1979. He specializes in international relations, geopolitics, geoeconomics, and Russian foreign policy. His academic work often explores the interplay between security institutions, conservatism, and Eurasian integration. Deaton has also contributed to journals like Russia in Global Affairs and authored several books on geopolitics and international relations.
Mr. Glenn Deaton, it's a pleasure to have you here on SOAP.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
I want to talk about, you did a dissertation on EU and NATO relations with Russia. I want to see, of course, nowadays everybody is speaking of forming a new military force in Europe because of the 2% argument with the US and everything. How feasible do you think that idea is?
2%? Well, it would have been more feasible before. Now Europe is in a deep economic crisis. Now, on principle, I would think it's a good idea, but it depends. It depends to what's end. To what end? Yeah. If Europe spends military and becomes more self-sufficient, America, then I think it's going to be a positive thing, because when you have huge security dependence on the United States, it will use the security dependence to extract political concessions, economic loyalty. And this is why the Europeans often do things which are against their own interest. So if we arm ourselves and push and say, you know, make the Americans, step aside or, you know, go home, then I think this could be positive, because then at least we would use our military to enhance our own national interest. But I don't see this happening. I think it's we're just going to add this to the United States arsenal and look for more military solutions. And from my perspective, that would be the worst we can do now, because this was the curse of the unipolar moment. You know, usually the point of departure in security strategy is you want to mitigate or reduce security competition. You can't just have two countries, more weapon is more security. No, you have to reduce the security concerns of your opponents as well. This is usually what security strategies are about. Instead, hegemonic international order you're so overwhelmingly dominant that no one can, you know, it doesn't matter if they're fearful, they can't do anything anyways. This is the hegemonic order. We have to move away from this. This is why when we have conflicts with the Russians, the first impulse is, well, how can we defeat them? But as I said before, the solution, you know, first you pick up the phone to find out if it's necessary to fight this war. And we haven't done this.
Exactly. Thinking about the European pattern, how possible do you think there would be for the Middle East to have the same sort of regional kind of togetherness and unity from a matter, from a perspective of international relations, sort of convergence?
Well, it should be possible. I mean, we often see, for example, the Gulf states and Iran have tensions, but if you see the things that unite them versus what divides, it's there shouldn't be these tensions to begin with. I think, again, a key curse is how do you organize the international system? And it's been kind of common sense, not anymore, the past 30 years, but it's always been common sense that peacetime alliances are a terrible thing for stability because it perpetuates conflicts. The entire internal structure and power depends on conflicts continuing. And again, the problem with the hegemonic order is it's dependent on alliance systems. So look at the United States. As long as you have some tensions between Iran and the Gulf states will be dependent on the United States. They will have economic, political loyalties because of security dependence, and you can contain and weaken Iran. Now, if peace breaks out, suddenly, you know, Iran's not contained. The Gulf states will start to act more independently of the United States. So there's always this need to perpetuate tensions. And you saw this when the Chinese, because they're not going for hegemony. They wanted to do economic, you know, connectivity with Iran, but also not alienating the Gulf states. So for them, they had an incentive to improve ties. And this is what they did. They were pushing for better relations. And you saw what was the first thing that happened? I saw a former Mossad chief writing an article that, you know, oh, if the Gulf states are not going to be part of this anti-Iranian alliance, maybe we should try to make peace with the Iranians too. And suddenly it looks like peace might break out. But then what is the hegemonic role of the United States? So there's always this need for conflicts and tension. And at the end of the day, I don't think it's good for the United States either. I think they're throwing away the republic in the pursuit of empire. And they're going to lose both at the end. So I think this would be a positive some solution. Just find a way of transitioning away from alliance systems, block politics, and try to move into some inclusive security architecture. Because, you know, both Iran and, for example, Saudi Arabia have a lot of grievances, but you're going to live in the same neighborhood. You're going to have to, you know, it's in your interest to find a way of living together in a good way. America's away. They don't live here. They don't have that same interest, same as in Europe. They don't have, now that the war went wrong in Ukraine, the continent is on fire, they can go home, which they are. And so you should always prioritize your neighbors first and find some inclusive arrangements.
I don't know, of course, this is a little bit academic, but as an international relations student myself, I would really love to know your perspective on that. How do you approach the study of conservatism in the context of global politics?
Well, it's that's a big question. Well, conservatism, it often assumes that the stability of the present rests on the past.
Yeah.
So, which is why, look at China, for example. It's undergoing huge changes, with its economic rise. So, when it's blowing dust powerfully around you, you need some stable anchor. And you know, they look into their 5,000-year-old history, their traditions, customs, and culture, and this is something that creates some stability. For countries like Russia, they're also discovering conservatism as a path, because Russia has a very revolutionary history. You know, they had the old Kievan Rus, they had the Moscovy, they had the European Russia under Peter the Great, Soviet Union, the failed liberalism of Yeltsin. So conservatism means you try to integrate all of your history into one national narrative, in which you bring the communists, the liberals, everyone's a Russian, and everyone's part of a similar narrative. And so this is becoming a new, in a more complex world under a greater change. I think this is the direction they're going. And the opposite of this is the neoliberalism, where the markets control everything and society is just an appendage. You know, wherever the economy goes, this is where society goes. And I think after a nice 40 years of this system, it's a natural for the world to, the pendulum swing to go the other way, for countries to not wanting to be states, they want to be states with economies, not economies with states. And I think this is the direction they're going. And to have economic integration between countries, but still being distinctive and different. This is what the Chinese, by the way, say with their global civilization initiative. They're saying we don't want to be, representing universalism like the Americans with liberal democracy, where they say we're all the same and we're leading the best principles, because then you can't have sovereignty. They're saying the opposite. They're saying, each civilization should develop at their own pace and find their own path to modernity. So it's not for a Chinese to tell, for example, an Iranian how you should develop your country. So this is also conservatism.
Right.
Recognizing our distinctiveness, and that this shouldn't be a goal of globalization to eradicate distinctiveness, rather to have more connections and mutual understanding.
Right. About that, do you remember the JCPOA in 2015? Of course you do. There were supposed to be economic ties between Iran and the US and the West and everything, and I think maybe that would preserve the deal. Trump seems to be very interested in economic investment and deals. He always says, I'm the art of the deal or whatever, the book that he has. But at the same time, he was the guy who got out of JCPOA and stopped the Boeings, the Airbuses to come to Iran. That sort of economic tie, wouldn't that preserve a sort of a compelling peace in the region?
No, if you have economic incentives to preserve the peace, that's always a good thing. I think he made a big mistake, I think that's part of the struggle now, because a lot of American politics, the reason why the U.S. often acts irrational now, the definition of a rational state is one that acts in its own national interest to maximize its security. But you often see that states act irrationally when there, for example, is a power struggle within. The United States is becoming very, very polarized. So whenever he expresses his foreign policy, it's often a reflection of what's happening within. So, this was a deal. It's a bad deal. He's going to make a better deal. So you throw it out, and then you're going to negotiate something new. It's going to be very hard now, because there's no trust anymore. But on the principle of what you said, I agree. I think if you can create some economic incentives for cooperation between Iran and America, a lot of the problems could go away. So that would be positive. But then
some sort of codependence.
Yeah.
Why is it that nobody's after that? Like keeping the country out of the loop, economic loop in the world, what result will that have for the world? I want to know that, really.
Well, this is the thing. I'm not sure. That's why I'm not certain if the Americans are completely genuine when they say that they just want to solve the nuclear issue with Iran, and then we can work together. As Trump says, I want Iran to be prosperous and strong, and but just no nuclear weapons. But is that true? Because at the same time, they're saying, Iran can't have long-range ballistic missiles. They can't. They have to decouple from the resistance. So don't do anything to oppose Israel. What they're asking for is more or less a capitulation. And if if Iran gives up its ballistic missiles, then the security will depend
no
on
deterrence,
the
right?
Yeah, they so Iran's security will depend on America's good intentions, and this is not how security works.
Yeah.
You have two sides or more. They have often reasons to have security concerns for each other. You address their mutual concerns and try to reduce it. So if you want Iran to have a less vigorous ballistic missile program, you should try to find out what is actually the concerns of Iran. So this is kind of the irony of what America's doing, because they're saying you have to have less deterrence or we'll bomb you. Now, it doesn't take a genius to explain why this is contradictory. Once you start to threaten countries, they will seek to have deterrence. So you can't threaten a country to give up its deterrent. It doesn't make any sense.
And how would they kind of expect that another country would accept such an offer?
I think it's max pressure, and that's what you're seeing now. And again, this region has, that is the Western Asia, has many different competing interests. And, you know, some have legitimate concerns about Iran. Iran has legitimate concerns about others. I think it's a key flaw in human nature that we often divide, you know, when we look at us versus them, that we do assume that we're always the good guy, the other guy is always bad. So we assign, right. At least in the West, there's a tendency to assign the assumption of bad intentions of Iran. And we assume that they can't work with them. And it's not they're not reacting to security concerns. They're acting out of belligerence and evil, right. If you will. Right. And I think this is the main flaw, because it's not good for America either. They can actually make peace with Iran. But first you have to talk to them as an equal. That is, they have security concerns. America, you know, I always tell people, don't hate your enemies, because all strategic thinking goes out the window. And
exactly.
I think that's very, for me at least, that's very evident in America's relations with Iran.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. How do you integrate neoclassical realism into your analysis of global dynamics?
Global dynamics?
Yes.
What do you mean?
I mean, if you want to come to an analysis of the current global dynamics, how would you justify that with neoclassical theory?
Well, neorealism is a theory which assumes that the international distribution of power dictates how states behave. So, the world always gravitates towards a balance of power. So, for example, in World War II, you have a big Germany, and so then there's an incentive for the Americans and Soviets to work. Once the Germans are destroyed, what are the main two powers? Well, the Soviets and America. So then natural, they will balance each other. So this is how, so neorealism becomes a theory on the balance of power, which creates systemic incentives, which states have to act upon to maximize their security. But neorealism is not a foreign policy theory. It assumes also the premise is that states are rational. My argument is they're not always rational. That is, between the distribution of power and foreign policy, you have an intervening variable, which is the human element. And if you have a decision maker in Washington, is he interpreting the balance of power properly and implementing the foreign policy? Likely no. He's going to have, like all other human beings, he's going to have his flaws. He's going to be lacking information. There's going to be domestic competition between different forces. There's going to be ideology, commitment to international institutions. There's a lot of reasons why people not always don't act rationally. So, for example, with Europe now, a lot of the policies Europe should be pursuing, they're not, because I don't think there's much political imagination to imagine anything besides the transatlantic partnership. We lived under American protection for 80 years, and a lot of our strategic thinking has been outsourced to the Americans. So when we are kind of going separate paths now in a multipolar world, there's not much political imagination to think of something different. And I think this is our huge curse at the moment. There's just full thinking and looking back, trying to recreate the 90s or something along this line. So I think this is what makes states irrational. And if you want to see a lot of the problems we have today, I think irrationality is a key part of it. So that's kind of the core of neoclassical realism, which is the contesting the assumption that states behave rationally.
Right. Thank you for that answer. And what research are you currently working on? I'm just curious.
Well, I'm trying to finish a book now on the crisis of liberalism. And I do some comparisons to what happened in the 19th century and what's currently happening now. Because there's a common idea that liberalism comes, whether it's economic or societal, political, that it comes with many advantages. But it's also the assumption that the liberalism as, call it an ideology of liberation of the individual from the group, that there's a, in its victory, it kills itself. For example, Alexis de Tocqueville, 200 years ago, he made this point that liberalism, that the individual carved out rights for itself outside of the group, that this was a very positive thing. But he also noticed that it doesn't stop. The longer it's free, the freer it will be. But what does freedom mean? It means eventually it will free itself from its from the group, from the society. So less connected with your own society, disconnect from culture, disconnected from your neighbors, family, your traditions. And at the end, in his words, he wrote something along the line that finally the human being will be completely in its complete freedom. It will be alone in its heart. So it will be, and this is not human nature. Human beings are a social animal. Anyways, my point is you disintegrate a lot of society, and you see a similar problem in the economic sphere. That is, if you look at John Stuart Mill, he pointed out that, during economic or globalization, as it was in the early 19th century, you often have democracy and liberalism going hand in hand, because people will vote for the liberal, and the liberal will contest the more conservative societal structure. But once you go into problems, that is after globalization, what do people want? Do they still vote for economic liberalism? And no, they start to retreat into the group again. They want protection for reproducing traditional values, culture. And now you have the democracy not supporting liberalism anymore. So you have a conflict there. And I think you see this today as well. Yeah. So anyways, I just realized you asked me what I'm working on, and I went on for a bit
too
long.
That's interesting,
there.
Of course.
Always be closed, so I say.